program, and we had a wonderful postgame show last night. We had Adrian Dater, and a little bit afterwards, D-Mac, Matt Smith. So a veritable cast of thousands here at The Fan covering the Stanley Cup playoffs as the Avalanche continue to advance on with their fifth straight win. And, oh, by the way, yes, the Avalanche have not gotten past the second round, not only in the last 3 years, but all the way back to 2002. That was the last time the Avalanche got past the second round, and they had reached at least the second round in five of their first 6 years here in Denver. We got kind of used to it, and now it's been 18 years. I have a feeling they make breakthrough this year, but we'll be covering it all the way right here on Denver Sports Station 104.3 The Fan. It's always a pleasure to welcome Dr. Rick Perea to our program from Think One. And Rick, we've been texting back and forth recently, but I don't know that we've talked since the night of the draft, but I want to get to that point first. Unless I misunderstood you, you were telling me that you were as busy on draft night itself as maybe you have ever been. You were getting lots of calls on draft night this year. Why do you think you were getting so many calls this year more than in other years?
Well, good evening, first of all, Sandy. Great to be on your show again. You know, I think one of the reasons is we look at, again, the impact of COVID has had on our larger society. But then we also look at in a micro level of the NFL, for example. And so a lot of these players have gone through aspects in their programs, in their college programs, where they were almost shut down for a whole year. Many of them were. And so there's a lot of psychological aspects that have come into the behavior of these players in this draft that haven't really come to fruition before, because now we're 2 years into this thing. I'm talking about COVID, by the way, COVID-19. And a lot of teams are understanding how the behavior of players has changed. I mean, we know in psychology that thoughts lead to feelings. Feelings lead to mood, and mood leads to behavior. And many of these players are behaving in ways that we haven't seen before. When I go on college campuses and I talk to coaches, and as a matter of fact, I'm working with a college coach today, doing through FaceTime and Zoom, and talking about his depression that he's going through because of what's gone on in the last 2 years. You know, he's been in three cities in the last 2 years in terms of his employment.
Right.
And he's going through a lot of change, and the players are going through a lot of change. And some of these players aren't adjusting as well. So I think NFL teams were more keen than ever to find out the psychological and emotional performance of these drafted players or potentially drafted players. Because, as you know, Sandy, we've talked over the years, the neck down is just one element, and that's the physiological. But the neck up, that is the difference maker. That's the game changer. We've seen quarterbacks come into the league, and they dominate at the college level, and then they never really develop at the pro level. And for the most part, that's because the neck up. And so teams are becoming more and more interested in trying to understand how they can evaluate the neck up, because as we've seen here in Denver, this team here in Denver has missed on a few of the quarterbacks they've drafted recently. And it's not the neck down, it's the neck up.
Oh, no, no. It's absolutely right. And that is something at which coaches, particularly those of the old school variety, are not terribly keen on plugging into. Is that a good enough euphemism to use? And I guess my question would be now, do you find not only front offices, but coaches and coaching staffs more open to these kinds of effects? There being less talk now, especially in this COVID era, that we're still experiencing, maybe not in quite as severe a way as we did for a little more than 2 years, but it's still out there. Do you find fewer coaches, both on the major collegiate level and in professional football, saying less often, hey, it's just football?
Yeah, absolutely. And to answer your first question about old school coaches not necessarily plugging into it, they don't. And the reason is, Sandy, is because they don't quite understand it. You know, they look at psychology as pathology only. And pathology means, like, what's wrong? What's wrong with the player? What's wrong with the coach? What's wrong with the front office person? And by the way, when we work with these teams, we don't just work with players. We work with coaches.
Sure.
We work with front office people. But they think of psychology as looking at only the pathology. There's not just pathology. There's wellness and performance that fits on the other side as well. And what we do is help people, you know, perform at their top level, but also have a balance in their life. So the old school coaches are finding themselves on the outside looking in, because more and more of the young bloods that are coming up in the coaching ranks are having to understand these psychological assessments that we use with players. They're used at the draft. They're used at the combine. They're used all the way back in college, that a lot of colleges are using them on prospective athletes. You know, I was talking to a different college coach than one I was talking to earlier today, and they were asking me about a particular high school player that I know, and they were really high on this kid. And I said, you know, you ought to come watch him in the weight room, because the kid just lays around and he just talks on his phone. He doesn't work out. He's a great athlete. He's got great size. He's got all the measurables. But the intangibles, they're not evaluating and they don't understand. They need to watch kids in the weight room. They need to talk to their families. They need to talk to friends, because that'll really show the true story. And that's why some of these kids, you know, they rate as a 5-star, 4-star, and then they get to the college level and they flame out. So more and more coaches, administrators are understanding how important psychology is, but not only pathology, Sandy, not only like the downside of what's wrong with someone,
sure,
but it's also wellness and performance, how to put them in a great spot for success emotionally and mentally.
We were texting back and forth today, and you made mention of the fact that Tim McManus, the outstanding writer for ESPN, called you and spoke with you a few days ago on the quote-unquote mental health crisis in the National Football League. Now, that's ESPN's terminology. Is ESPN correct, in your opinion? Is there a mental health crisis right now in the National Football League?
That's a great question, Sandy. And I'll tell you what, you know, Tim is a very, very effective journalist, in the sense of he can get information when sometimes it's not there. But I'll tell you, the way that he asked me the question and the way we ended up talking about it, when he asked me if there was a mental health crisis in the NFL, my first inclination is to say yes. But my second inclination is to say, you know, there's going to be a lot of people that are not going to drink that Kool-Aid. They're going to say, well, no, I don't see it. What are you talking about?
Right.
We're talking about, you know, a few players here and there that are on the edge, that are doing things, you know, like our kid Brown in Tampa Bay that happened earlier in the season.
Right.
But there really is, in my opinion, Sandy, a mental health crisis from this perspective, from the perspective that a lot of players, current players, are not necessarily getting their needs met. So if we look at Major League Baseball and what Major League Baseball has done, they have mandated that every team has to have 2 and now 3 mental health coaches on every team. You have to have that. The NFL does not have that rule yet. They do need to institute it. And really what is happening on many NFL teams is they're just checking the box. Yep, we got a therapist, we got a psychologist, we're good. But they're not serving their players in the totality of the way they could in a more eclectic way. For example, they need a clinical psychologist who can handle pathology. They need a performance psychologist who can handle wellness and performance. Those are two different things. So a lot of the players, as you know, Sandy, are out of this league in 3.1 years. That's the average length of an NFL career, is 3.1 years. And I ask the listeners out there to think about this. What if somebody told you, as a CPA, as a dentist, as a trash collector, whatever you do for a living, you could only do it for 3.1 years? Most people would not go into that industry because there's no longevity in it.
Right.
But yet we have literally 1,600 to 1,700 players every year that play in the NFL, and the majority of those players are gone in 1 to 2 years. Now, what do those players do who have made a salary of anywhere from $300,000 to multiple millions of dollars? They can't go back into society and make that kind of money. They can't go back into society and get the kind of adulation and attention that they got before. So there's always a psychological and mental adjustment that happens with these ex-players. Some of them retire on their own terms. Very few do that. Most of them are told they're done, that their services are no longer wanted. And I can tell you, Sandy, being part of that Super Bowl team here in Denver in 15 into February 16, there's several players on that team that have been retired and are done that are reaching back out and they're saying, wait a minute, you know what? I feel like discarded trash. I feel like I was just put out to trash. Now, the average fan would say, well, they get compensated. Sure they do. But there's rarely a stage in this society where you get the attention and adulation that you do as a pro athlete and make the salary you do. And that changes brain chemistry. That changes the way neurons fire in the brain. So when you go back and try to adjust into everyday society, it's a tough adjustment, Sandy.
Before I let you go, I want to, and this is purely coincidental, that we had you on tonight, but it occurred to me today that 5 years ago tonight, you were by my side when we received the horrible news about my son's suicide. And maybe we ought to do this, even if it's not on the air, every year. But it's a special pleasure to have you on tonight, especially to talk about this particular subject.
You know, Sandy, I couldn't be more honored to be on your show tonight. Again, 5 years ago, I was by your side and,
yes, you were.
Everybody talks about things happen for a reason. And there was a reason that we went out to dinner that night, not knowing that when we got back that, the sheriff would be there waiting to talk to us. And I got to tell you, there's no better friend I've had in the world in the last 5 years that I have seen grow and shape and develop and help so many people that have gone through this, that they know people who have either taken their life by suicide or have considered it. And there's so many adolescents out there as we speak, Sandy, that are struggling right now. And I just want everybody to know that there's options. There's options that we don't have to make permanent. But I will say this, Sandy, I love you. I believe in you and I trust you. And I'm so thankful for the friendship.